Welcome to Women with Issues, where we talk about policy issues that matter to women. In this series, we're focusing on the 2020 presidential campaign and the role of women over 50 who represent a powerful voting bloc that could decide the election. We are nonpartisan, bipartisan, and our only goal is to shine a light on the issues so that you can make an informed vote. We are your hosts, Diane Kilivers and Tracy Maxwell Hurd.
Hello, everyone. Tracy. How are you?
Good. We have a special guest today, don't we?
Yes, we do. We are very honored to have with us today Sandra Moody Gresham. Sandra has a 40-year career in the financial services and insurance industry. And we're going to be focusing, of course, on healthcare today and with a closer lens on COVID-19 since we are going through that pandemic right now. But Sandra is the ideal guest to have this conversation with because we have an opportunity to talk about something that really hasn't been part of the overall discussion as we've been talking about this pandemic, and that is the role of healthcare as we're trying to navigate through this.
Yes.
For everyone. Sandra, as I said, has 40 years experience in the industry. She is a past chair of the Columbus Association of Health Underwriters, and she is the chair-elect of the Ohio Association of Health Underwriters. So Sandra, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome. We're very excited to hear from you,
Sandra.
And understand that you have also just come back from the National Association meeting for health underwriters. Is that correct?
Yes. And good morning, ladies. And thank you so much for inviting me to share with you guys this morning. Yes, we have our National Association of Health Underwriters Capital Conference. It was in February prior to the COVID crisis really becoming present in our country. Where we essentially lobby and talk to our legislators about issues that impact, you know, our communities and our clients and laws that impact each of us every day. So it's really kind of exciting to kind of look at how the industry functions at that level and how that we can influence and take the messages of our clients and our customers right directly to Washington.
Right.
And I think you're the right one to be in that role because you are a woman over 50. Am I correct?
Yes.
And since we're really focusing on this Harris poll that was done by AARP magazine that showed that women over 50 are 95% of us are likely to vote in the upcoming election. And 69% of us are yet undecided on how we will vote. So, and also that healthcare is their number one priority. So you're a great representative for that.
Yeah, we live it every day, you know, as women, as employers, as, you know, industry professionals. We see it. We see it every day in our homes. Women are the decision makers in most households, and there's a huge percentage of single women headed households. So this issue is really relevant from that whole sandwich generation where we're caring for parents and we're caring for children and mates. So we're often that caregiver, but oftentimes we forget to care for ourselves in that process. So decisions around healthcare are critical. Because we live it every day.
Exactly. And you just rolled right into exactly what I wanted to say. We are at that point, we women of a certain age, where we are still offering care to children and sometimes grandchildren, as well as parents that are still living. So we're giving a lot of external care. And one of the things that we often forget is, you know, what I call the airplane rule, you know, to take care of ourselves, put your oxygen mask on first. Because
right.
If we go down, the whole thing tends to crumble because we're the ones that are making sure everyone else is getting taken care of.
Yeah.
But as Diane said, healthcare was the number one issue of concern for our peer demographic here, and for a number of reasons. Because of what we just discussed about us being the primary caregiver, because 26% of women said, the reason it's such a big deal is because 26% of us believe it's way too expensive. It's put 14% of us in debt. So we're really challenged in managing this just every day in normal situations. Let's talk a little bit about how COVID has really magnified this, and what are you seeing from the health insurance side of this? What do you think that seeing that's happening that may be magnifying some of our issues or really helping us focus on mm-hmm. what our challenges are?
Sure. Well, as you guys know, there are a large percentage of our population is uninsured. And there's a vast, even greater number that's underinsured. And so how we view underinsured is if your out-of-pocket costs, your deductibles, your coinsurance, your co-pays, if they exceed 10% of your annual income. So if you think about it, and many of the plans right now have $5,000, $6,000 deductibles. So the average household doesn't make $50,000 in America, right? So there's a far number of us who are insured, but yet we're underinsured because of these huge co-pays and deductibles. So those are deterrents for people using their health insurance. They don't want those bills. In America, the highest percentage of bankruptcy is due to medical bankruptcy because of past medical bills.
So, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, so in a system where everybody should have access to health care, far too many people do not, and it is unaffordable. Health insurance is expensive because health care is expensive.
Right, right.
It's been tremendous. But in terms of COVID, the industry has stepped up along with the federal government that no co-pays, no deductibles will apply for COVID treatment or COVID testing. So that is if individuals have coverage or they do not have coverage. So that's critically important and a great need. So we don't want Americans to fear not stepping out to get tested because of money.
That part of the CARES Act that was passed, the $2.2 trillion coronavirus legislation, and maybe you can expand on what all is covered under the CARES Act.
Well, specifically around the health insurance side of that, because healthcare open enrollment, open enrollment is in November and have coverage available to anyone starting in January of the following year, there was a push to reopen open enrollment. And that did not occur. The administration refused to do it. And that's applicable for 32 states in our country. There's another about 13 or 15 states that have a state-run health insurance program. All of those state-run states opened open enrollment. They reopened it. So individuals that did not have coverage could access it. So in lieu of opening healthcare.gov, the administration said, we will just reimburse hospitals and physicians any cost incurred for testing and treating Americans with COVID. So that was their strategy to help, right? So nobody's being turned down if you are require a test, if you need treatment for COVID-19. The downside of that is there's a short window. It's only till right now, depending on the insurance company, to the end of May or the early June or when the emergency pandemic crisis is officially closed by, an elected official determines that date. So you may need treatment beyond that. You may have some other illnesses beyond that. So this whole lack of access to healthcare, folks being uninsured is a critical need. And it has demonstrated the disparity in other communities, the African-American community, the brown community, who there's been a historic disparities in access to health care. Right. And now the Band-Aid is being pulled off of that and a light shining on that because of the fact that they don't have quality health care, the fact that they have underlying health conditions has caused the deaths of the Black Americans. And I think I heard somebody say up to 7 times,
I actually have some statistics here. In Maryland, 52% of coronavirus deaths have been in a Black community, while only 31% of the population there is African American. In Michigan, 41% of the deaths have been African-American versus only 14% of the population.
Yes.
In Louisiana, 70% of the deaths have been
it's huge.
Black people of color, while only 32% of the population.
A lot of that stems from the underlying health issues. You know, unfortunately, black folks are sicker. And so it makes us more vulnerable if a virus impacts our body as well. So
this is really shining a light on that then. You're right. Yes. And in New York, I just wanted to mention one more. Latinos represent, 34% of the deaths in New York.
And those are states that are having the highest incidence of exposure and sickness to begin with. And I mean, when you're looking at what the national numbers are, it's African Americans are 21% of the overall population, but we're 42% of the deaths.
Yes.
Not just those infected, but we're 42% of the deaths. So, you know, what are the underlying, you know, as you said, Sandra, it's not just about, you know, the access and, you know, things like cultural competency and how the health industry engages us when we do show up. Are we showing up soon enough, you know, when we have these symptoms, or are we waiting longer because, you know, such a large percentage isn't covered or hasn't historically been covered and just used to really waiting until it's critical and can't, you know, manage that on their own. And as you said, we start out sicker because there are all kinds of underlying health issues that make us vulnerable to begin with, that, you know, our numbers always tend to be higher, whether you're talking about diabetes, heart disease, all the issues that are hitting the overall community are hitting the African-American community at even higher numbers. So we're going into this pandemic in a deficit.
Exactly. So it really does exposes those issues, but it also says the resources need to be targeted to those community where is disproportionately impacted, right? So since we know this, we can't just blanketly everybody gets the same resources. Let's target those areas that these deaths are occurring more aggressively. So, I mean, we hope to see a change coming on the other side of COVID where these issues address ongoingly, because we shouldn't have a crisis to address homelessness. We shouldn't have a crisis to address food insecurity, the cost of healthcare. We shouldn't have crisis to, to realize we have to address these issues, and we need to address them in those targeted areas where the greatest needs are.
Exactly. We're bringing a huge focus on the deficits of PPEs and, you know, of testing and all of the issues to actually address the pandemic at large. But the conversation has just started really this week about how do we manage these disproportionate numbers that we're seeing in the African-American community? What do we do about that? You know, in terms of increasing testing there, you know, is there adequate access to healthcare and those kinds of things? And as you said, this is really just shining a light on all of the holes that have been there and all the bandages that have been patching this, our healthcare system together just in general. So how do you think on the other side of this, this might impact our conversation just around healthcare, universal healthcare, you know, private versus everyone being on Medicaid? What do you think that conversation might look like in light of how we have or have not managed this pandemic?
Sure. Well, as you ladies know, this is all political. So who we elect in office makes a difference, right? From the federal level all the way down to our local communities. So we have to be engaged. This is time to complete the census. So we have to be engaged. They have to be able to identify where communities are, how that demographic looks like. But I also, we also have to self-engage, not only voting, but how we engage with our medical community, right? We have to communicate, we have to ask questions, we have to take someone along with us if we feel uncomfortable asking the questions. We need to prepare for that dialogue with those medical professionals. And then we have to look at what's our personal responsibility in this as well. Many of the deaths, you know, not considering the COVID crisis, but many of the deaths are due to preventable diseases, right? So we're showing up with illnesses that we can impact, right? Smoking, for example, right? There's still, smoking shortens life expectancy, right? It also enhances absenteeism. These are the people who don't show up at work on a regular basis. And and it ties to other chronic diseases. So there are things that we need to do personally as well.
For sure.
So do you think coronavirus will become the number one argument in favor of national health care or Medicare for all?
Well, again, it certainly puts that spotlight on it that how could this issue been better addressed that if we did have universal health care? I was reading about, I believe it was Taiwan, they use an electronic system. Mm-hmm. So when folks showed up, they knew their medical backgrounds.
Right.
They even, because of COVID, they tie their travel history to that medical database. So we know if you, you know, travel to China, what other areas you had traveled, that would exacerbate your conditions or how we had to treat you differently.
Could that be a reality here, though, with HIPAA privacy laws and, you know, Taiwan's a different, you know, it's a different country.
Sure. And I mean, that's the challenge. So, you know, we in America, we have moved to electronic records. Right. So there's been a push to do that from the Affordable Care Act. So we've moving down that path. But that would be private information. Only your doctor knows that information and you have it. But, you know, it's secured and you figure out this mechanism to make it secure, but it's accessible to every medical professional. That's the key there.
Okay.
My challenge with that is every time I go to the doctor or I have to go get blood work or something like that, it doesn't seem to always be up to date. I mean, there's, you know, for example, there's a medication that I've never taken in my whole life that somehow became a part of my record. They ask me about it every doctor appointment, every test, everything. And I keep saying, no, didn't happen. Never took it, never got it. So that, I mean, that concerns me. I can bear witness to the fact that these electronic records definitely are being put together. My only concern is, you know, we've got to make sure we're doing a good job of managing that. Like, for example, about this medication, the one thing that I was told was, well, the person that put it on has to be the one, is the only one that can remove it. Well, can anyone identify who that is? Yeah. So, you know, there's, I think we're moving in that direction, but there's little hitches in the giddy up, you know, about how really, you know, smoothing that out and making sure that it is efficient and most importantly, that it's accurate.
But, yeah, there's challenges in all of this.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and we've really got to look at the pros and cons of it. But again, those, if we're dealing with a large homeless population,
right,
you know, that never shows up at the hospital, but on occasion they have, and we got data on that person's health history.
Right.
So there, this change is hard for us. And when we look at the pros and cons of a universal healthcare system, if it's a single payer or multi-payer, system, that's tough for America because we like choice. We like choice in America. And then our demographics are so different where you live in the country.
Sure.
Right. And then again, to your point, you mentioned about the deficiency in resources from a hospital system. We have communities in rural areas of the country that may only have one small hospital. Don't have access to equal physician, number of physicians based on that population. So there's a lot of work to do, even if we move to a universal system, that access, where are these professionals coming from? Where are those facilities available to meet the needs of those communities?
And I'm really excited about this whole telemedicine thing. You know, I'd been doing some physical therapy before the whole quarantine started. And that was one of the things that my physical therapy provider offered to me was they were going to be doing some telemedicine, you know, to kind of do a face-to-face and continue to walk you through, make sure you're still doing your exercises and doing them, you know, correctly. And I'm really curious to see if we accelerate that because telemedicine isn't new, but how we engage it certainly, because, you know, you mentioned something that I really hadn't even thought about before you mentioned it, and that's our homeless population. How does insurance even play, health insurance even play out with our homeless population? Because I'm going to assume probably don't have it. Although there are people, there's a segment of our homeless population that is employed. They don't have homes, but they have jobs. So any information about how that plays out with that demographic?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. But to your point, those who may have had jobs and think about the caliber of the jobs they had are probably in those industries that don't offer a lot of health insurance.
Correct.
So that's a tough population because you often need an address to enroll in healthcare. and then you don't see them, will they come make it easy to access them to go to have a visit? You know, that whole population creates its own set of issues. That I don't think we've really addressed. I did, Diane, before you speak, I did want to comment on the telemedicine. All of the, pretty much all of the carriers now offer, all the insurance carriers offer a telemedicine option for people, or it's just baked in their plan. So I look at this similar to old school dial-a-nurse. When you got sick, you could call a nurse 24/7 and they would talk you through if you needed to go to an emergency room or just, you know, go to bed and take an aspirin, right? So now you can just visually see that doctor or talk on the telephone with that doctor. COVID has exacerbated that. I was on a call with one of our insurance companies, and in 2 weeks, their teledoc calls went up 500%. So of course they weren't prepared for that, and the wait is longer. But this is where the industry wanted people to get to, not in this way, but this is certainly becoming a much more common way to access healthcare. And think about those rural communities I mentioned, where you don't have as many doctors, but if you got good broadband, you now can access that physician.
Well, and that's another issue too. Do they have, you know, good broadband? But you know, I always said, you know, every family, you know, everyone needs a nurse in the family, you know, even more than a doctor, because you have a doctor in the family, you know, doctors are busy, but a nurse will talk to you. I used to have my first husband's sister was an RN. And, you know, when my kids were young, you know, and something, you know, happened to them, they weren't acting right, I got on the phone and called Allison.
Quick question on this telemedicine. Definitely efficient. And with the exception of things just really being overloaded now, because that wasn't expected to be engaged so heavily during this pandemic. But, you know, balancing that out and having the accurate, you know, staffing for that or appropriate staffing for that. Is telemedicine, it is more efficient, is it more cost-effective, specifically for the patient?
It is more cost-effective, because think about if that individual going to the doctor's office, right, or going to the emergency room or the urgent care. So just showing up increased costs. So now I don't have to show up. The doctor can prescribe a prescription and today they can deliver your prescription to your house, or you go up and pick up that prescription. So the time is minimized, the cost is minimized, and often those visits are shorter as well. You're not spending as much time in the doctor's office, nor is the doctor who probably spending as much time with you. I watch my husband, so his doctor's office operates in this way. So the nurse still calls him first, maybe an hour before the meeting, and does all that pre-work and preparation and asks all the questions. And then the doctor, she communicates that with the doctor, and then the doctor calls him at the scheduled time.
Will you get to a point where they could take your blood pressure that way, you know, take your temperature?
Well, that's it. With seniors, they're prescribing the equipment at home, so they could take their own blood test, get a scale, so you can stand on a scale. If you have diabetes, do your testing. So when the nurse calls, you can report that information, and you have got your log.
That'd be great for you. You'd never have to leave the house.
It's amazing.
Tracy's a nester. She doesn't like to leave the house.
That's totally fine with me. And then I only have to be dressed from the waist up, you know?
Right. Ring come true for you.
So let's, you know, we kind of started with talking a little bit about this article that has been driving our early conversations here, this AARP article that's focusing on the Harris poll on women 50 and older and how we are likely to engage at such high numbers in November. You know, 95% of us engaged, though 7 of 10 have not yet necessarily made their decision. Although since the poll, I would say that that number has probably shifted because the poll was done in December, and we are now down from 22 candidates, or 24 if you count all sides, to 2. We pretty much know it's going to be Vice President Biden and President Trump. So likely more women have, you know, picked a side, so to speak. But from a healthcare perspective, What are the things that you think we should be listening for, focusing on around this, you know, how the pandemic was managed, and what are the things we should be listening for as to what's important in the decisions that we're going to be making going forward? What do we look to hear from these candidates?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, when you look at those candidates, one wants to keep the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. and the other wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, but has not proposed an alternative.
Right.
All right. So, you know, I kind of believe we will get to universal health care. Mm-hmm. I do believe we will get there. However, how do we make what we have better, right? More efficient, more accessible. So some of those, one of those areas is Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. So what you may recall, when the Affordable Care Act was established, states could elect to expand Medicaid, which just made it available to more people,
exactly.
right? Increase the income guidelines for eligibility.
For sure.
So not all the states did. So mostly those southern states with the highest poverty populations are most of the states who didn't do it.
That's right.
Where the need was greatest, right? So exactly. every state should be required to expand Medicaid, because right. that'll close the gap for so many people. And that program, the federal government reimburses the states a lot of that money to do it. So it's not like the state carrying a burden for all that excess cost.
Yeah.
But I think that's key.
Ohio did that. And it was a great example of something we don't do well most of the times, mm-hmm. which is bipartisan work. You know, I was still in the yeah. legislature when we did that, and we did it with a Republican governor, and we had two Republican chambers, but, you know, Democrats and Republicans had to come together to really make that happen and to bring forward a bipartisan vote to push yeah. that through. And I think it was really important and has still continued to serve this state well, especially through the pandemic. So, you know, it's probably going to be more of a hybrid, don't you think? I mean, it's not going to be, we're not going to abandon private health care.
No. No. So, I mean, that's just one thing, because, again, you're looking at the percentage of our population that are low income, working poor. We talked about the homeless community. Those are the ones that were eligible for Medicaid.
Right.
And so if more people could access that, and when you look at the numbers of uninsured in our population, mm-hmm. half of them have access to coverage. And just for whatever reason, financial or otherwise, elected not to enroll.
Well, you know, right now, you know, I talked about my son, who's 22, who lost his job in January, just a few weeks before this pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And it was a minimum wage job. He had been working for a year and a half at a pizza shop. Got tired of working for minimum wage after a year and a half, and lost his job. So he did apply then for Medicaid, you know, in between jobs, and weeks went by and we heard nothing. And then, you know, COVID-19 hit, and suddenly, you know, everyone's applying. And I actually had to get on the phone and spend a couple of hours on hold. And I finally got it done. I finally got him covered, you know, thank God. Now he's actually been hired by another company. Yay. It's a better job. It's a higher paying job. But the wait times are going to be just incredible.
And it's always, enrollment in Medicaid has always been time consuming and burdensome. And it's worse now because of these Americans losing their jobs from COVID-19. So more people are eligible because of income loss and job loss. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how do we make those systems more efficient and better, and then looking at the future election, you know, I think expanding access to Medicaid is going to be important to do. Mm-hmm. Transparency in costs is another important issue when we right. look at healthcare. You can't compare, you know, if I got to have hip surgery, that all the hospitals, if I just want to go online and see how much each hospital charged for the hip surgery, I can't find that.
Right.
I can't find that information,
right? right?
And the variation in those costs are huge, mm-hmm. right? So we don't know. We can't we can't find out the cost of services until after we have the services, exactly. Which is just backwards in America, exactly. Right? So there's a lot of legislation, both at the federal level and locally, about establishing more transparency. How do you assess the caliber and competence of physicians, right? Okay. So there, I should be able to go out and say, who's find the best hip surgeon, mm-hmm. in Columbus or wherever my locale is, right? So again, and insurance companies are beginning to do that in their sphere of the world. They know what these doctors are doing. They're looking at their industry associations for grading and scoring them and communicating that information out to consumers and giving consumers choice. So if you use these higher scored physicians, then your copays may be less, mm-hmm. right? So they're trying to incentivize consumers to use better, more efficient, better performing physicians in hospitals, which manage costs better, mm-hmm. right? And thus push that cost down, cost savings down to the consumer. But the other one, again, in terms of access, and you guys may know with healthcare.gov, it provides premium subsidies or discounts based on income. So mm-hmm. you're above Medicaid, but you're, you know, up to 400% of the federal poverty level right now, you can get a discount on premium. That number maybe needs to be 500 or 6%, 600% of federal poverty level. So again, more people have access, pushing that cost of coverage down sure. to fits more reasonably in the budget of households. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that we just have to tweak and work with what we have as we move to a universal system.
Everyone talks about how, you know, for example, Bernie Sanders advocating for Medicare for all. Well, people, how are you going to pay for that? How are you going to pay for that? Well, is it true that administrative costs are, what I read was about 13% of the total costs of healthcare. A lot of those administrative costs would be eliminated in a single payer system. Is that correct?
Correct. There's a lot of duplication in our system that we currently have. Just as Tracy mentioned, everywhere she goes, they keep asking the same question. Right. There's a lot of duplication, a lot of overhead, a lot of fat.
What
that
about
can be drilled down?
Also, you know, I went for an x-ray. I play tennis and I injured my foot. And, you know, I went for an x-ray and all of a sudden I was getting a bill from the doctor, a bill from the hospital, a bill from the lab, a bill from the radiologist. I mean, so many different bills. Wouldn't that be combined into one bill?
The Medicare for All proposals, and there are a number of proposals out there with different nuances. The Medicare for All is a universal healthcare strategy, right? It's one approach. And it's designed as it's called a single payer. So essentially what the proposal that Bernie Sanders put forth is that the federal government is going to pay for all healthcare, right? And it will be it will be available to every American, automatic enrollment at birth. So you would only get one bill. You wouldn't get a bill. Let me correct that. You wouldn't get a bill because the systems would pay. If you think about Medicare, our current Medicare system, which is health insurance provided for those over 65, those bills go right to the federal government. The federal government pays the hospitals and doctors for care. You do have some out of pockets, but they're very limited today. Right. So the Medicare system we understand today, Medicare for all is really not that. Okay. Right. It will be totally changed. Okay. And I think part of the media has not really shared that Medicare, as we know Medicare, won't exist.
Right.
Okay. Exactly. Medicare for all is a good spin and a good selling.
Oh, phrase, I see.
Right. So, but to your point, Diane, you wouldn't get those bills. No right. one would get a bill. No one would have an out-of-pocket cost. No one would pay premium. But again, where's the resources come for us to do such an enormous, massive system? Should there be some copay? You know, every family pays, you know, $20 or some number based on income. Right.
Exactly.
So we have a multi-payer where the consumer pays something, maybe the employer pays something. You know, there's so many models and there's pros and cons to each. But I think we're going to get there. We have to get there.
Pros and cons to everything. I see that at least, you know, I really haven't heard much from Biden since the pandemic started. But his plan prior to that was, you know, a hybrid, keep the ACA, Obamacare, lift this firewall so that people who don't like insurance through their company can go to the exchange. Whereas I think right now, I don't think they're allowed to do that. I don't quote me on that, but it would be better for lower paid employees. So that's a choice, a hybrid. But
is there a table, Sandra, where all of the conversations are happening? Because it just always feels as if we're all coming from our respective corners, you know, and fighting for what we think is the best thing, which may not be the best thing. We may not even agree that it's, you know, as a healthcare recipient, as a healthcare provider, as a healthcare insurer, you know, everyone has a dog in the fight, so to speak, and trying to protect their respective positions. You know, patients certainly want the best care at the lowest cost, you know, with the most access. You know, insurers are trying to make sure that all the bills are getting paid and hopefully that costs aren't too high. But, you know, then we have the challenge of, you know, patients are challenged by insurers making decisions for them that they don't necessarily want them to make all the time. You know, who their doctor is, what medications they're able to take. And then you have the hospitals who are businesses and are trying to, you know, stay in business and keep revenue coming in. But hopefully, you know, their objective is to keep costs down as well. Not always certain of that. You know, as Diane said, you know, when you're getting six bills for one procedure, is cost management for the patient really even part of the conversation? So the question behind all of that is there a table where we really get to have this kind of conversation? And it's not just, you know, all three parties having a conversation with themselves in a vacuum, but coming to a common table.
I think they're at that table now.
Okay.
All of the various stakeholders, you know, even pharmaceutical companies, equipment makers. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many stakeholders when you look at this healthcare.
Right.
Right. So I think they're all at the table. The president is pushing and requiring that discussion. Because technically right now he doesn't have a plan.
Right.
He just wants to get rid of ACA, but we don't have an alternative.
Right.
So all of those stakeholders are at the table. But to your point, they're kind of holding on to their sphere of the world and don't want to change that.
Right.
But there's got to be give and take from every aspect of this to make this work for the betterment of the consumer. That whole piece, is it a right or is it a privilege? Mm-hmm. Is healthcare a right or a privilege?
Mm-hmm. That's the big question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what I understand and what I've experienced, I also teach insurance over at Franklin University. When I pose that question, because we study health insurance, and I see that the responses line up based on net worth or in family net worth.
Wow, that's interesting.
It really is, right?
Wow.
So the higher the income and net worth, it's a privilege if I can buy it. You know, we use examples and you think about this. Magic Johnson learned he had HIV applying for life insurance.
Wow.
Magic Johnson is still here.
Right.
You can't tell he ever was sick with HIV.
Right.
And you Life's can't... You hear what I'm saying?
Right.
So if you can buy access, you're likely to get the caliber treatment
you know, need. And that's what I think, going back to the coronavirus pandemic, is really, really illustrating that big time. Because you can't, doesn't matter how much money you have, you can get coronavirus. Doesn't matter, you know, whether you're white, black, this is something that nobody can prevent. Nobody has a cure. We're all in the same boat here. And doesn't matter, you know, how well you've taken care of yourself, you can get coronavirus. You can die from coronavirus. Right. And the people who are getting it the most are the people who are still working, are the bus drivers, the maintenance people, the lower paid individuals are the ones still on the job. the grocery store workers, and so they're the ones being impacted the most. And it's that just illustrates the unfairness.
And another place that the unfairness seems to be illustrated is around the testing, you know, because when you hear about people who have gotten the test, especially people who've gotten the test that are coming, they're testing negative. So many celebrities have been tested.
They're asymptomatic. How are they being tested?
Right. Exactly.
That's to your point.
Mm-hmm. But then there are people who have symptoms that can't get a test.
Right.
When you look at who those people are, there definitely seems to be an economic disparity around access to this test, which is hugely challenging because, again, there are more of us who don't have that huge amount of wealth than those that do. So if we're neglecting to test the larger segment of the population, that can't help but play out badly for all of us.
Exactly. And I mean, when in times like these, when you have these major health crises, that's when it's exposed. And it really boils down back to income and assets.
Well, this is a long, long, long conversation, even just around the COVID-19 pandemic situation. This is not going to go away anytime soon. We're still even under quarantine. They've not yet determined if the quarantine is going to be lifted at the end of this month. We do know that kids are out of school for the rest of the year. The concern now is there's conversation about, is there going to be a second wave of this in the fall, which would, you know, impact us, you know, have the same dynamics happening again that are happening right now. So this is going to be an ongoing conversation. And of course, the conversation around healthcare definitely will continue until we come to a better solution for all of us. And November of 2020 is going to be revolutionary, I believe, in terms of healthcare and the decisions that we're going to make as a nation around this because of what the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed in terms of our vulnerabilities and disparities and things we always knew, but that are going to be happening in real time when people are going into the polls or will have just subsided if, God willing, we're lucky enough to have moved through this. And be on the other side of this, you know, but it'll still be fresh on people's minds because one of the challenges that we have in our electoral system is people have very short memories. But I believe COVID-19 will still be fresh in our minds, whether we're still under quarantine or, you know, if we're just getting back to normal, it will still be present enough to be part of the conversation in consideration of, you know, these two candidates going forward. So Sandra, we'll be talking to you again in our part two of our health conversation. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Informing us, ladies.
And helping us navigate through this. I mean, it's so important to make sure that people are aware of what the options are and that they do have options. Because again, we were really concerned that this was a part of the conversation that wasn't being had publicly. It was being dominated by deaths and tests and PPEs, but no one was really talking about the foundation of all of this for all of us that are facing this. So really appreciate your presence today. Diane? Well,
thank you, Sandra. It was wonderful. Great information.
Well, thank you, ladies. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
Stay safe and encouraged.
Thank you. This is Women with Issues.
And we're talking to you. Have a great day.